Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
While many observers say Florida's education system is in crisis, some are skeptical of whether any change will come from an emergency education conference this week in Clearwater.
I've been watching this thing unfold for the whole 9 years I've been superintendent, and I take everything they say with a grain of salt.
And in another Florida summit this week, while Department of Children and Families officials work to fix the state's child protection system following the deaths of 20 children since the month of April, a group of former foster kids are putting in their two cents.
It's awful that those things had to happen for this to occur, but it's good that it is happening now, and they've restructured how they're investigating abuse and neglect.
We'll also hear about genetically engineered food and how hard it is to track human trafficking. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. And before we get this edition of Capitol Report underway, Stan Jastrzebski has some late-breaking news about a speech that Florida Governor Rick Scott made today.
Scott announced his plan to seek legislative approval of the cuts during a speech to the conservative group Americans for Prosperity Friday in Orlando. The Republican governor has sought tax cuts every year he's been in office. Shortly after he was inaugurated in 2011, Scott sought tax and fee cuts of $4 billion over a two-year period, but those deep tax cuts were rejected by the GOP-controlled legislature that was struggling with a budget deficit. Scott did not specify which taxes or fees he wants to cut. One possible target might be rolling back automobile fees that were raised in 2009. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Stan Jastrzebski.
A hastily convened summit in Clearwater has education watchers cautiously optimistic that Florida's varying education factions may have reached a consensus. Lynn Hatter reports the summit, convened by Governor Rick Scott, brought together state and local school officials, lawmakers, teachers, and others for and against school reform policies.
The summit came as Florida navigates a rocky transition to new education standards. The state school grading system is facing questions about its validity and that of a new teacher evaluation system.
We are in a bit of a crisis, but it can be fixed if people would put aside politics and really begin to come up with real answers.
Miami State Senator Dwight Bullard is a social studies teacher and critic of Florida's policy of grading schools and teachers. He's also not a fan of the way the state has gone about implementing new learning goals for students called the Common Core. One of the biggest issues facing policymakers is what to do about Florida's school grading formula. The State Board of Education had to extend a safety net preventing schools from falling more than a letter. And had that rule not been in place, the number of failing schools would have ballooned into the hundreds.
And really, a lot of times you have to have a tragedy to realize that, look, we got to come together and fix this. And the school grades were a disaster this year.
Bay County School Superintendent Bill Hussfeldt says he believes the school grade problems were a wake-up call. Florida has been steadily increasing its test performance standards for students and teachers as it phases in Common Core. And more than 30 changes had been made to the grade formula in less than a year. Alachua County School Superintendent Dan Boyd says he's seen enough.
I would like, personally, to just stop what we're doing until we get it right, cut it out. Because I have reached the point where I have no faith in it.
Boyd says he hopes the summit will lead to a serious review of Florida's education policies. And while some have criticized Governor Rick Scott for being absent from a summit he convened, Boyd commends the governor for calling the conference in the first place.
So I appreciate Governor Scott. I appreciate the fact that he is assuming leadership in this arena. I am very, very hopeful that we can make some positive impact on this, because it's broke right now, and I think it behooves all of us to get it right, because too many lives are being affected by this and we don't have it right.
You know, I would hope that everyone could end up in a place that has a open forum for people's views on this as we move forward and the implementation is done.
Meanwhile, Hillsborough County School Superintendent Mary Ellen Ilya says she hopes lawmakers will actually take the advice teachers and local officials give them into consideration. There have been other summits in the past, usually ending with one group having its recommendations ignored. Ilya is also urging the state not to get cold feet when it comes to the Common Core. She says talks of scrapping the tests aligned with those new standards is premature.
I think the assessments need to be nationally normed assessments, and that means a test that is not a specific Florida test. Other places are using them, so you will know, in fact, how Florida really aligns itself to other places in the country. And I think that's an important distinction.
And Alachua County's Bill Husfeldt, who attended the summit, says he feels a consensus is emerging on how the state should move forward. Husfeldt says while many of the policy rules governing grades and evaluations will stay in place this year, lawmakers could stave off some of the penalties attached, which could help with the transition to Common Core. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida educators weren't the only ones holding a high-profile meeting this week. The Department of Children and Families' recent troubles took center stage at the group's Child Protection Summit this week in Orlando. As Regan McCarthy reports, the event drew record attendance with 2,500 guardians ad litem, DCF workers, and members of the justice system, along with a group of former foster kids who offered their take on issues facing the department.
In contrast to recent meetings about the rash of children who've died under the Department of Children and Families' watch, the Child Protection Summit's kickoff sounded more like a concert. And while Interim DCF Secretary Esther Jacobo says she's glad to see that kind of passion, she says it's important to remember the challenges the group is facing.
Before we can talk about our promise, we need to speak several names. We speak their names because, through no fault of their own, they suffered and died. These are children who we collectively knew as a system of care. We start by speaking these names because they remind us of our challenge. They remind us of our awesome responsibility. They remind us of our commitment.
And as DCF officials work to change direction, several former foster kids talked about their own experiences and some changes they'd like to see. They're part of a group called Florida Youth Shine, which had a hand in getting a piece of legislation nicknamed the Normalcy Bill passed last legislative session. The measure gives foster parents more say in what their kids can or can't do, rather than having them get an okay from the courts.
It feels strange to ask someone to if they want to hang out for the weekend or go see a movie, and you have to respond to them and tell them, yeah, I'd love to do that. Let me go ask the judge and see if I can get that passed by Friday. And so it really veers you away from having a lot of friendships and the normal experiences that you can have.
That's Daniel Pettis. He says he thinks the new rule change will really help kids who are growing up in the foster care system now. This year, the group is pushing to make it easier for foster kids to get driver's licenses. Right now, it's hard for foster kids to get driver's licenses because they often don't stay at one address for long and face both different insurance regulations and concerns about who's liable if they get into an accident. But as far as the department's current problems, Pettis says based on his own experiences, more funding and more services for families would be a big help. He says his mom struggled with addiction when he was a kid and often couldn't find enough money to make ends meet.
She loved us to death, and she did the best she could to raise us, and we all turned out good kids. We just had to go to foster homes because we were in poverty. So we got taken from someone who loved us to put with strangers when some preventative services could have rearranged that, and then we could have lived as a whole family and not have had to experience any of that.
Chelsea Bramblett says she had a similar experience when she was placed in foster care at the age of 15.
My mother, she loved us to death. She did everything. One thing we didn't lack within our household was love and support. And my mother had everything besides the money and the services that she needed.
And Bramblett says besides providing more services, the DCF should focus on educating parents about the services that are available to them now.
When the court case was open and they started coming in, She wasn't really offered those services and saying, hey, this is, we have these programs available for you. If those programs would have been available, she would have been on track to get her kids and take care of us. But we were placed into foster care and had to age out of foster care. And if she would have had those services, we wouldn't have had to be separated from our family and face those problems.
Both Pettis and Bramblett say if a kid must be removed from their home, the state should put more emphasis on keeping siblings together. Bramblett says it made a huge difference to be placed with her sister.
I don't think that I would have been able to get through the foster care system if I hadn't have been placed with my sibling, because as Daniel said, we went through it together, we suffered together, we understood the problems that we faced, and we were each other's support system.
The group also says helping kids who come into foster care when they're older, and therefore aren't as likely to be adopted, prepare for the real world is an important focus. It's something they say another piece of legislation that passed last session will help with. It extends care eligibility to a foster kid's 21st birthday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. Still to come on Capitol Report, as some lawmakers begin to debate about what should be done about Florida's Stand Your Ground law, some wonder if the law just needs clarification or something else.
I am interested in looking at the legislative proposals to fix it, but at the end of the day, if I feel as though they don't go far enough, I will still continue to move the repeal of Stand Your Ground forward.
Florida officials wrestle with trying to get an accurate handle on the scope of human trafficking in the state.
At this point, like I said, we really just do not have any accurate information on what is actually happening within the state of Florida.
And the movement for labeling genetically modified food is picking up steam once again in Florida with a bill filed this month. Several Florida lawmakers are hoping to legislatively reignite the debate surrounding what should be done about the state's Stand Your Ground law. Some hope to repeal the controversial law, while others say the law just needs some clarification. As Sasha Cordner reports, while those same measures never got a hearing this year, some lawmakers say the 2014 legislative session is the perfect time to have such a debate.
The next step in the discussion comes in September when the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee holds a hearing on the law. A vocal proponent of the Self-Defense Law Committee Chairman Republican Representative Matt Gaetz says he doesn't feel any changes need to be made because there could be unintended consequences, but he appears amenable to some sort of clarification.
I think that if we'd like to make the law clearer, it might be more beneficial to invest resources in training for law enforcement and prosecutors and maybe even judges on the legislative intent and on how the law can be applied fairly. So we'll be open-minded in that sense.
But Senate Democratic Leader Chris Smith says there already have been unintended consequences.
I think when the legislature envisioned and voted on Stand Your Ground, they didn't envision the gang members and the aggressors being able to use this as a safety net to their bad acts. They didn't envision law enforcement being unfamiliar and not knowing whether they can detain someone or arrest someone while they at least investigate. So we try to clear up, it's 8 years later, but some of the things that we've seen that's wrong with Stand Your Ground.
Smith's bill includes provisions making it harder for aggressors to claim Stand Your Ground and allowing law enforcement to fully investigate such claims. That's similar to a bill drawn up by Stand Your Ground author David Simmons. The Altamont Springs Republican, like Smith, has refiled a bill that never got a committee hearing during the 2013 legislative session. Their measures also incorporate some ideas recommended by Governor Rick Scott's Stand Your Ground Task Force, including guidelines for how neighborhood watch programs across the state should operate.
Since they're put together by local law enforcement, we believe that they should have the ability to actually implement certain regulations for anyone who is a member of Neighborhood Watch.
Meanwhile, several Florida lawmakers have been calling for a repeal of the law, including Tallahassee Democratic Representative Alan Williams. Still, repeal seems unlikely, and Williams says he's willing to listen to the bills offering fixes to the law. But Simmons says those calling for a repeal don't understand the law.
It's just something that, unfortunately, by virtue of a tragedy, has been brought to light, and many people, because they don't agree with the result of the Zimmerman case, have latched upon something. And it's a piece of legislation which makes good sense, other than a few tweaks that I think need to be done. Everyone acknowledges who understands it is necessary in a civilized society.
Simmons says Smith has indicated that he and the rest of the Black Caucus would be willing to co-sponsor his bill. Both have also been in talks with Republican leadership to get their bills heard next year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kordner.
A new national study shows federal prosecutions of human trafficking cases have exploded by 400% in the last 5 years. But as Ryan Bank reports, tracking trafficking cases is not an exact science.
Florida ranks third in the nation in calls to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. More than 1,000 people in Florida reported trafficking crimes in 2012, but law enforcement officials fear the actual number of trafficking cases could be much higher. Human rights lawyer Terry Coonan says it's probably because real trafficking crimes aren't as visible as what we see in some Hollywood movies.
Nationwide, they estimate, you know, maybe about 18,000 people annually are brought in for human trafficking, and it's rarely kidnapping. That kind of scenario that we see in movies like Taken with Liam Neeson, we hardly ever see.
All right, listen to me. Go to the next bedroom, under the bed.
Tell me when you're there.
Now, the next part is very important. They're going to take you.
Hollywood theatrics aside, human trafficking is a dramatic crime. And according to the Syracuse research firm Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, or TRAC, prosecutions of trafficking cases have seen an equally dramatic increase in recent years, about fourfold. But TRAC's co-director David Burnham says those numbers stem from a very specific type of human trafficking.
The study we put up looked at prosecutions under a law specifically passed by Congress to deal with trafficking. And under that law, the federal government, the prosecutions by the federal government have gone up very sharply.
The federal law Burnham used in the study deals with sex trafficking and was passed in 2000. But Terry Coonan says other forms of trafficking are far more common in the Sunshine State.
Now, here in Florida, though, we do believe that we probably have more labor trafficking victims than we do in sex trafficking.
Human rights advocates and law enforcement officials agree. Tracking cases in the state is close to impossible because the crime takes so many forms. And that's reflected by the wide range of statistics that exist. Only a small fraction of all trafficking reports, sex or labor, make it to a courtroom, and not all prosecutions end in convictions for trafficking crimes. And Giselle Rodriguez, spokeswoman for the Florida Coalition Against Human Trafficking, says there's no central database for human trafficking statistics because local and state agencies don't always communicate with one another.
Our agency has tried to obtain information on how many cases have been found throughout the state, and it's been very hard to try and compile that information. So at this point, like I said, we really just do not have any accurate information on what is actually happening within the state of Florida.
But state officials say that is changing. With the passage of the Florida Safe Harbor Act about a year and a half ago and the consolidation of the state's human trafficking statutes, law enforcement has a much more effective investigative toolkit. Florida Attorney General's Office spokeswoman Jen Meal says her office is also pushing for more interagency cooperation.
So Attorney General Bondi has worked with the business community, law enforcement, and state lawmakers to approach this from an all-hands-on-deck perspective.
State officials say it's that perspective that's leading to more prosecutions, and there is one statistic that backs that up. The same research that shows the Sunshine State third in trafficking cases also rates it in the top five when it comes to addressing the problem. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Relatively few issues that get taken up at the state government level ever come as a total surprise. If you listen carefully to who's saying what, you can often figure out what topics may be hot when lawmakers get together for their yearly session. One such signal may be going out right now, and it involves the matter of government regulation, specifically too much government regulation. There's been a lot of talk about government overregulation in recent years. Much of it has come from Republicans who have tightly tied the issue to federal health care reform, a.k.a. Obamacare. Here's Republican U.S. Senator from Wyoming, John Barrasso, speaking with Fox News's John Stossel a few months ago.
This is the red tape tower, John. It's over 7 feet tall, and these are just the regulations that have come out so far because of the Obama health care law. There's over 20,000 pages.
But there's a more general objection to government regulation that's gaining traction in some political circles. That aspect was voiced by North Florida Republican Congressman Steve Sutherland during a recent visit to Tallahassee.
Burdensome regulations that are thrown upon us that sometimes just don't make sense because the city inspector asked us the same questions last week that the state inspector is asking us today, and it's going to be the same questions that the federal guy is going to ask next week.
In other words, regulatory duplication and non-coordination amongst the various levels of government. And the smaller a business is, the more burdensome that is, says Bill Hurley, who heads the National Federation of Independent Business in Florida.
For a business that has less than 20 employees, it costs them about $2,800 more per rule to comply with that rule than it does for a business with 500 or more employees.
Hurley says it's not that his and other business groups are necessarily against all government regulation.
We always think of these regulations as a very necessary thing to rein in big businesses. That's so. But what we're trying to put a light on is the additional cost that are placed on small businesses when they've got to comply with those same laws.
And like his district's congressman, Hurley also is concerned about conflict and duplication when it comes to different levels of government regulation.
How long can we spend so much time and energy between various levels of government with small business owners stuck in the middle? The uncertainty of it is also what we want to recognize in how that affects businesses.
One thing appears to be certain, however, since Florida Governor Rick Scott recently trumpeted that he and lawmakers have done away with more than 2,000 state regulations, the push will be on to encourage the same at the local government level. That could wind up being a major issue in the 2014 Florida lawmaking session. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Food containing genetically modified ingredients would have to be labeled as such if a bill filed this month passes the Florida legislature. As Jessica Palumbo reports, the bill's sponsor says people should have the right to refuse genetically modified foods. But food biotechnologists say supporters of the bill overstate the dangers of genetic engineering.
Tallahassee Democratic Representative Michelle Rewingle-Vassalinda is sponsoring the food labeling bill. Sitting on her front porch, she says she grew up in a farming community and she's always felt close to the land.
Actually, my husband's got a garden back there that doesn't have genetically engineered food that I know of.
U.S. laws don't require such labeling, although other countries, including the European Union members and Japan, do. Rewingle-Vassalinda first filed the bill last year after she heard from a group of activists who had collected more than 1,200 petitions from Floridians.
It's just, it's an amazing group of diverse, you have African American, white. I mean, it just doesn't matter. People are concerned about what they want to put in their bodies.
Lina Kochek is a South Florida-based organizer with the National Food and Water Watch, the group that approached Rewingle-Vassalinda.
You know, there haven't been any long-term health studies done on humans. The foods are unlabeled and they're largely untested. And the tests that are done, you know, are oftentimes done by the companies that are working to get them approved.
But some scientists say the activists are inflating the threat. Florida A&M University professor Violetka Kolova says she supports people's right to choose what they eat, but points out farmers have been modifying genes for thousands of years. The difference, she says, is the technology is now more precise and allows people to combine genetic material from a wider variety of species. Scientists can make crops resistant to pests or cold weather, for example.
That means we use piece of life to improve peace of life.
Outside FAMU's Viticulture Center, acres of grapes grow in the hot Florida sun. But inside the growing room, different kinds of grapes are forming.
So we're in a grape nursery.
Yes, it's a grape nursery for cell lines.
Petri dishes with various colors of grape cells grow under bright lights on large metal carts.
We just make them regenerate. When we move that cells to a specific media, they start producing these tiny plantlets.
Anthony Anenga is a lead researcher here.
So we want to look at specific proteins that we see has got the real medicinal component and see how you can increase the productivity of those proteins in grapes.
So making a healthier grape?
Making healthier grapes.
The scientists reject the claim that genetically modified foods are unsafe because the federal government regulates them just like other foods. But Kolova says only a multi-generational study of people eating nothing but genetically engineered food would yield scientifically significant results. And there just hasn't been time for that.
Of course it is a rush because the opportunities are so big. Many breakthrough research in this area, these are multi-million, multi-billion impact.
In the U.S., the food biotechnology industry has exploded over the past 15 years. Today, the USDA says about 70% of processed foods contain some genetically modified ingredient. And the industry's profitability leads many in the anti-genetically modified organism, or GMO, movement to be suspicious. Tallahassee gardener Priscilla Hudson has been meeting with Representative Ray Winkle-Vasalinda in support of the labeling bill.
When I read that that was going, you know, the deal with the GMOs, I decided to cut them out of my diet just to see if that was the issue. And like I said, within 3 months, my health has improved considerably.
Hudson says she and other campaigners will be pushing conservative church leaders to join the labeling movement by getting them to oppose what they see as unnatural foods. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Banks, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.